Accession of 1193A to Rail 39.
Mr. G. Iston, Reel 39. Following Alam Halfa, were you getting close to the time when you were taken out, taken away from airfield duties and brought into the action in the line?
Yes, well, at the end of Alam Halfa, Rommel decided he'd had enough on the 3rd of September. And that night, on the 3rd of September, the New Zealanders did a counterattack. And on the 2nd of November, we left our positions on the 2nd of September, sorry, did I say November before? September it was. On the 2nd of September, we left the airfields. I suppose they decided by then that the nights weren't right for paratroop dropping and things like that. Anyway, we left on the 2nd of September, and we went up behind Alamein line, sort of in the second or third line back, not in the line itself, but not in the second line, well, probably the third. We were well back from the main line, and we spent the night there in trenches which had already been prepared by somebody else. It was just a matter of getting there, dropping into the trenches and having a night. Now, the next night, the New Zealanders, who were in the front line of the Alamein line, they did a counterattack against Rommel's pivot, which was infantry, trying to cut his a line through to leave his tanks exposed, what was left of them, because the Air Force had had a field day. He got caught in soft sand, and the Air Force had a field day, so his tanks left all over the place. But on the night of the 3rd, the New Zealanders went in to try and make a gap for some of our tanks to get through, but unfortunately they were held, and they were held in rather a bad spot. So the next day we moved into the Alamein line itself, where the New Zealanders had been before they did their attack, and we took over their positions with the New Zealanders in front of us, and we stayed there all day. And that night, I think it was the night of the 4th, the New Zealanders came back through us and left us in the front line position.
Can you describe those front line positions?
Yes. It was a similar situation to the one where we came back from through the Alamein line. There seems to be a lot of sources. The Alamein line was a ridge running from north to south. And behind this ridge, there'd be a saucer, and then another ridge behind that again, and then another saucer, another ridge behind that. That's how we come down three lines on the three ridges. The infantry positions, the four companies, they went in trenches on the forward slope, observed, where they could be observed by the enemy. And then just under the ridge on the other side, we had battalion headquarters, and I had my spot just going up to the next ridge. It wasn't a bad spot, really. Cleaner than Amaria. We shelled fairly regularly. But we're only something like, maybe 30 miles from the sea. So it was much fresher than we'd been used to for a long time. It was close to Alexandria, so there was plenty of fresh food, vegetables, Stella beer, Egyptian brew beer, some Canadian beer, Australian beer, American beer. And fortunately, now in Gazala, I think I did mention that we got some up there, and we lost half of it because the bottles didn't get cooled down. But now, with a fairly reasonable supply of beer, we're able to dig it down and let it settle and cool off a bit and then drink it, which wasn't too bad. It was still a little bit too gassy, like a Pilsner ale. It wasn't really to note hotels, which there was beer, and it went down.
Was the water situation better?
Oh, terrific. No bother at all. And we could rope any time during the day with our sand petrol fires. We're feeding on our own pretty well. The cookhouses had moved up for the infantry companies, and they were in just beneath the ridge, and they were cooking for the infantry, and if we wanted anything particular we'd go across and see them. But we're in the situation again where you didn't have more than five together at any one time. Well, you tried not to have more than five together at any one time in case if you were spotted, I mean, you're going to get something lobbed at you.
This is what, five people in one?
Five people in one group.
And how were you dug in?
The digging was fairly good, just here. They'd had plenty of time. I mean, they'd been there then for two or three months. So they were pretty well dug in. All tins were buried. You know, you dug tins and after you'd had your McConaughey's or your tin pairs or whatever it was. The food was really terrific now to what we'd been used to. We were getting a different type of supply of food through. It wasn't just bully beef now. I mean, McConaughey's were on the go, which is a great meat and vegetable stew, which was ready just to warm. You just had to warm it up in the punch of the can, warm it up. And I mean, the cans, to open that, you just rubbed the bayonet in, screwed it round, and the lid came away. So there was no problem with opening cans at all. But the McConaughey's and always pears. The food was really wonderful, and the QM came up every night with their fresh supplies. We didn't have a lot of vehicles in there at the front with us. In fact, for me, it was quite an easy time. The QM used to come up every night, and then we had to get the stuff out through the night to the forward companies. And if there was ammunition, of course, we used to try and transfer that to another truck and whatever we had. It might be a carrier, whatever we had. It would transfer the ammunition and take it out to the forward companies. Wasn't much sleep, but we got our siesta through the day. So we didn't do too badly.
You didn't move much on the surface during the day?
We weren't allowed to move very far at all. In fact, we didn't move a vehicle if it was at all possible. Occasionally we had to. I mean, if the CO was called to Brigade headquarters, obviously you had to go to Brigade headquarters, so occasionally we had to. There was a very strict speed limit so that you didn't throw a lot of sand up, because I mean, if you got your mix wrong with your petrol, petrol on the stove, and you sent a blue smoke up, you knew you'd have a shell hole within a very few minutes, and it wouldn't be very far away. So the same with sand. If you threw a lot of sand up and created, you see, there's always a wind. Well, I'm saying always, a lot of the time there's a wind, and it's different. You can see if you throw sand up, it sort of spirals up, which is different to a sandstorm, which comes across at you. And I mean, if anybody sees a spiral going up, they know that there's something moving. So they, again, you've got attention paid to you, which is your own fault in a sense.
What speed limit was this?
5 miles an hour.
And that was everyone?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Once you got over the out of the basin and into the next basin, then you could lift it up a bit. But even then, I mean, you were still within range. I mean, the third line was in range of the 88s. So you're still in range. I mean, you did sort your own peril, in a sense. At night, of course, it didn't matter so much because you got through the night and in time for the dust to settle before
morning. How far were the Germans away from you?
Oh, 2,000 yards. Maybe a shade more. About 2,000 yards. Well, nice, you see, I said that the forward troops were on a slope down facing the enemy, so they were observed all the time. And then there was this big... Well, it was just a big basin, that's all you can say about it, really, with humps in it, tufts of grass here and there, tufts of, it's not heather, it's marjoram and sweet-smelling stuff, really. It's not a smooth bottom at all, it's quite a rough bottom, and every now and again, those are these little bits of sand dunes where the sand got caught And in other places, you'd find that there was a stone ridge and then a load of sand behind it, like in a snowdrift, where the snow has gone over the top of the ridge and then sunk. And so if you were driving along, you'd go over this ridge and, of course, you'd straight into deep sand. This is what had happened to the tanks in Alamalfa. They'd been driven away from the place they wanted to be, and they'd try to get round further out and drifted further and further out till they hit the soft sand. Then, of course, they would just pray for the RAF after that, just what the RAF were waiting for.
Between yourselves and the German lines, what form did the defences take?
Patrols every night. Every night those patrols went out, looking for prisoners. Occasionally they were getting shot up themselves. In most cases they were firing patrol, and they might bring a full patrol back as prisoners.
Were you involved in any of this type of activity?
No. I was very fortunate. I didn't do any of that sort of work. The nearest I got to was after General Horrocks came. Montgomery had been down, and it told the colonel that we wouldn't be in the van of the attack anymore. Another one of his lies. But he had a little job for us, and Horrocks must have known what the job was, because he came back, and we were now getting quite a few reinforcements through. We got to the stage where we could sort of bring a company into reserve, but two companies forward, and were able now to get a company in reserve. And that company in reserve would be with battalion headquarters behind the forward slope. And they were taken out to do this special training. I can't tell you what that involved, because it didn't involve me at all. But with me not having much transport in the front, Colonel Watson decided that with Brigadier Percy being strict on his transport, that he would have a course, have me run a course for everybody in the line on maintenance. And the first one was for the company commanders. Well, I think it was two company commanders, and there'd be about seven, I think, at that particular time. And the CO was one of them. And I was sort of didn't like to tell these company commanders what to do too much. And I was
you were given the course?
Yes. And I was sort of saying, and there's the dipstick, and there's the filler for the gearbox, and there's a grease nipple up there. And the Colonel Watson says, "Come on, Iceton, let's get down underneath the damn thing and have a look at it." So, we did. That was the end of my being kind to the officers. They crawled underneath, and we had a good look at it. It was a good finish up in a good course. So I was having one of these every day now. It got down to the lads in the finish, and we had a good time with it, because the drivers in particular, they were asking questions, and of course it's always easier if you've got people asking questions. The time goes much faster than if you're talking all the time yourself.
Was this in your position, your own dug-in position?
No, this was at battalion headquarters, just behind the forward slope. You see, it was safer just behind the forward slope, because a shell coming over has got to get over the slope to get into the basin. I was in the wrong place at the backside of the slope. I was on a forward slope, you see. If you're behind the slope, I mean, you're much safer, because the shell's got to go over you, unless they bring mortars out, which drop more or less straight out of the sky. It wasn't mortars in this particular case. It was shells, and heavy shells. And we didn't have a lot of bombing, which was fortunate. We did have the odd occasional one or two. But we had quite a few dogfights over us. I suppose that Jerry was sending a few spies across to have a look around, and the Air Force was getting to know about it pretty sharp now, and they seemed to catch up with them nicely just over us. They were probably going further back, but we saw a lot more of the Air Force now. In fact, there was a South African Air Force, there was our own Air Force, South Africans, and I think we were getting some American pilots as well. Some of the Boston's and the Mitchells, they had stars on, so whether they were actually American pilots or they were using this as a sort of, they used the star in Northwest Europe, didn't they? Whether this was the start of the star as a Allied sign, I don't know. But quite a few of them had the star on.
Can we just come back to the defences before we go any further? We talked about patrols going out. Was the defence wired and mined in front of you, in front of the troops, between,
yes,
of course, between,
yes,
them and the Germans?
Yes, and of course, a patrol has got to go through a gap. During daylight, the patrol commander has got to have this fixed in his mind. In fact, if possible, he would go up the night before to see it in the dark. Maybe watching that night's patrol going out, so they could see the minefield and what was going on. And we sent carriers out. We've got one too. Captain Cole had come back about this time with not a lot of carriers, but some. And they were finding their way around. They call it the steppes, and I suppose that's a good description of it, really. Like the Russian steppes, in the Ukraine, where it's flat and... No, the Ukraine's the corn belt, isn't it? Anyway, they call it the steppes, this place.
No man's land was relatively flat.
Another basin. It was another basin, and they were on the forward slope of the far side of the basin, 2,000 yards away. But that doesn't say it in the bottom. There was hills as well, but not a ridge. The Germans were on a ridge on the far side of the basin. In the bottom, there's all sorts I've tried to explain, but it was rough ground. And I did say when we went up before, in fact, when we first got in the Alamein land, that we were laying mines in every direction you could think possible. And, of course, they were still there, some of these mines, so we must have gone back to somewhere the same place. They weren't going straight up and down. They were going up and down, and then they chewed out and put a little salient in. The minefield would go out and put a salient into the... to protect a bit of a height, or to keep anybody off that particular height. And we got the carriers out there a few nights, and they were finding their way around. And then they decided that there was so much stuff out there. The New Zealanders left quite a bit of stuff out there from when they were in the line, and also during their attack, they had left quite a lot of stuff out there. And it was decided this was cleared away. So then we started going out. The patrol would be going out to harass the enemy, see what they get in the way of prisoners. And we would go out in a separate unit to try and get things off the minefield and get them back into our own positions. And this is really where the tow ropes came in. I mean, we might have three or four tow ropes joined together. Somebody would crawl through the minefield.
Could you safely
hopefully
do this?
Not really. Sometimes a patrol would go out one night and lift mines to leave a gap. The problem we found out later was we didn't realise at the time, but the Italians were being crafty, and they were using some of these obstructions, carriers or vehicles. They were using some of them through the day to... They were going out at night, laying up in these vehicles and watching us. So, well, that was really the idea of getting off. I thought it was a mere matter of clearing the debris from the front. And we did get all sorts back. We got a 2-pounder gun. I think it was about 5 carriers.
You were involved in this yourselves?
We used to go out with the patrol to bring them back.
What would you take out to bring a vehicle or a gun back?
We'd try and take a carrier. Or maybe 2 carriers if we could. Sometimes that would be a vehicle. I mean, it depends what the situation was. Generally, they'll take me off through the day just to look at something and tell me what had happened and what the minefield was like. And then we'd discuss it and decide how we're going to try and attempt it. We didn't get everything back we went for. Sometimes we chased out. But we got quite a lot of it back. We salvaged a lot. And, of course, we did stop the hiding places that the Italians were using. This was a bonus that I hadn't thought about anyway.
This must have been pretty tense work.
Yes.
What about the noise factor? Because 2,000 yards, I would have thought noise would carry, particularly carrier noise.
Well, there was a problem, you see, that we used to try and... it had to be done as quietly as possible. That meant that the engines had to be low geared and as low revs as possible. So basically, it was just moving in a lot of, cases,
out.
Just creeping out. Yeah, you didn't want to pull it too fast in any case. I mean, if you've got a carrier on its tracks, I did say before that with it being a track layer, it's only gotten so much weight on its load bearing is so much less than a wheeled vehicle. That you can very often pull it out over mines and get it out. The problem with a carrier is when you try to slew it and you set mines off, particularly that way. But with it being a track layer, it does come out in a lot of cases, provided the tracks are on. And that was where I got into a lot of problem. You see, was going out, maybe having to put a track on before I could pull it out. Normally, we'll try and drag it out. Wherever it was, we'd try and drag it out with its tracks or not. And then possibly, once it was out in the minefield, we'd maybe go back the next night and try and... The trouble was, when he went back the next night and somebody spotted it had been moved, they had a machine gun fixed onto it, hadn't they? So you didn't always get there.
Did you lose people in this kind of activity?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we lost... In fact, I think it was about this stage where a letter from my mum saying that a friend of mine from Thornley, again, Tolo, I went to school with three of the Vickerses. They were auctioneers in Weardale. And I went to school with three of them. And the youngest one, I had a letter from mother to say that he was come out. And when I made inquiries, I suppose it was 3 weeks later, but he was dead. I'd never seen him. He'd been out and killed, and I didn't know he'd been. And that's not a very nice way to ride back and tell him that, thank you for your letter, but I'm afraid he's dead. Because my mother had worked for the Vickers when she was quite young, and she thought a lot about them. Well, we all did, really. I mean, John and... of the names now, but John was the eldest. He was quite a nice lad. We got on very well.
How long were you in this part of the line?
Quite a long time, because the New Zealanders, they came through us on the 5th. That was about 3 days after we'd gone in. And 44 Div came in. I can't just remember which way. Oh, it must have been south. They came in on our left, on the south. And they hadn't been in very long before I had to go down with the company to do an attack with 44 Diff to stiffen it up a bit. And then, just being back about a week from that, I had to go down a bit further still and do another one with the Greek Brigade, which was just a bit further down.
And what was your role in these attacks?
Well, just mainly support the carriers which were going down. I think it was really the carriers that they were after at this particular time. It was just really to support them. I never went on the attacks, really. They were, at this stage, we're sort of keeping the enemy worried and trying to make him think the attack was going to come from the south, the way he'd tried to do it. So there was all sorts of skirmishes going on. We were patrolling every night, and we did this heavy sort of fighting patrol with a company of the 6th and some of 44 do. I think it was the... Could it have been the Buffs? Well, I can't remember now. Home county, isn't it, 44 do? I just can't remember now. But one thing did, we went down one night and we stayed there the day and did an attack the next night. And while I was there, there's this damn great pylon going up in the sky. Oh, I suppose it was something like 60 feet high. And there was a bloke up there. I couldn't help thinking about this fella up there. I mean, shells flying all over the place. He was probably a gunner. But there was just this, I think it was two of them actually. There was one about 2 miles further south. But this one, we were quite close to it. In fact, I was glad to get away from it because it must have been quite a landmark. And this bloke up in the top there with probably an OP from the artillery directing his traffic. It was frightening. I often wonder about things like this.
You mentioned Horrocks. Did you ever speak to him? He came to see you.
He came down on a number of occasions. I did see him, not to actually speak to, I don't think. And we saw Monty as well. He came down. He didn't come down. We were sent back in groups. I don't know where I went. Must have been well north, I think, because I seem to remember it was a bit greenish, so it must have been well north. Must have been on the coast somewhere. And we sort of stood up and spoke to a lot of us.
Were you impressed?
Oh, he spoke well. A little squeaky voice, which carried. I often wish I had one like it. I had a manager later on, he had the same thing. His voice was the same here as it was 100 yards away. But it was a squeaky sort of a voice. It wasn't a man's voice, as you would say. It wasn't RSM's voice, anyway. But it used to carry, and he could make himself heard. And, of course, he had these little tricks. He'd bring a cigarette out and hand his cigarettes around. He's a non-smoker. Very much against smoking, but he'd try and get the truth by bringing his cigarettes out, and he certainly spoke well. I mean, he said what he was going to do. We will do this, we will do that, which he did, after some difficulties. But he did what he said he was going to do, and of course this went down well. But Horrocks, he was a charmer. He was witty. I don't know if he was particularly smart. He was a good looker, but I don't know if he was particularly smart. Although you couldn't really say that Monty was smart because he held his head forward. His head was forward a bit. There was not smarter generals than both of them, I think. But Horrocks, I liked him. I thought he was a great fella. And I enjoyed his series on TV when he did that. I thought it was terrific. In fact, I wish I'd had a shape then.
Were you getting any leave whilst in
No. Life? Not that I can recall. When we're in the air strip thing, yes, we used to be able to get away from the airstrip and go for a bathe, because it was that, it was 20 miles or something like that. So we jump in a truck, 20 miles, have a good swim, and back again. And there was occasional day trips to Horrocks, which again was about maybe 30 miles away. But from the line, I don't remember any leave.
What about mail? Was mail coming through?
Mail came up with the QM every night, and it was coming through fairly well, because I did explain about the little letter cards, and they were coming through fairly well then. And the naffy supplies, plenty of petrol, there was always plenty of petrol. I don't remember being short of petrol, to be honest.
Were there any other restrictions in the line, other than, of course, not moving during the day and travelling so slowly with vehicles?
Well, hygiene. Very, very strict on hygiene. If possible, any tins were burnt and then buried. Latrines were covered maybe twice a day. A trench would be dug for a latrine, and it would be covered with sand maybe twice a day to keep the flies away. And plenty of water, you could get washed. And I think that one of Horrocks' things, but he'd said to the CO, was you want to see us smartened up. Montgomery said different. He said he didn't care what a soldier looked like, as long as he did his job. But I think Oryx was more, he wanted to see as more professional. And I suppose he was right in a sense, because his dad got very, very lax. I was trying to remember now. Colonel Watson and I fell out later on somewhere in Tunis about the fore and aft, because the Durhams always wore theirs straight down with the buttons over the nose. The fore and aft was a silly thing. I suppose in the original idea it was correct. It was designed like a helmet. But when it wasn't a helmet, it all folded up and the two buttons from under the chin came out of the front. So really, I speak, it was a, I think it was called a field cap, a field forage, no. Might have been field forage cap, we call them fore and afts. And the Durhams wore theirs straight down the centre of the head, with the buttons right over the nose. Everybody else wore theirs on the side of the head, just held on by the ear. And I was amazed to hear Colonel Watson later in life complaining about the fore and aft. I forget what he called it now, some silly... Anyway, he called it a stupid thing. And because later on, he made me a Lance Corporal one day, and he caught me with a hat on the side the same day and told me, forget about it. I didn't get the stripe on the next day, but